Hey, book besties. I'm your host, Nikki, and I'm here with special guest,
Stevie, hi.
and this is For the Shelf Podcast. This week, we will be discussing Butcher and Blackbird. But before we get started, this podcast is intended for a mature audience. Use of profanity is a definite, along with mature sexual themes and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
So advised.
So advised. So I want to welcome our special guest host, Phoebe. Phoebe's filling in for Kelsey this week because she's got a lot going on. We should be back to our regular host schedule next week. But Phoebe, we're so happy to have you. Welcome.
Thank you. I am so excited to be here. Hi, everybody. I'm Phoebe. I'm a friend of the podcast. I'm the podcast number one fan. I am a sci-fi fantasy reader. I love horror. I love queer things. I love romance. So serial killer romance was right up my alley, and I'm really excited to guest star on this episode.
And again, we're just so happy to have you here. So I know Kelsey usually does the bookish news, and she's got all the dish on what's going on in the world, but it was my job this week. So this week's bookish news, a new Bram Stoker short story has dropped.
It is the year 2024. We got new Mozart and we got new Bram Stoker.
So apparently an amateur historian was going through random periodicals and literally found a short story called Gibbet Hill from 1890 that was written by Bram Stoker that just kind of got like lost in the ether. So I don't know. That's kind of cool. And it's perfect timing for spooky Halloween.
Personally, I actually think that Bram Stoker is kind of a dry writer. But you know, this is really cool for academics and people who liked Dracula.
I did not read Dracula.
Well, okay, sorry. I don't know why I'm making that face at you. Dracula, look, Dracula is a really important book, academically speaking, literarily speaking, as far as the vampire edition goes. It's a very important book. It is a very dull book. It's mostly epistolary. It is letters. It is journal entries. The Dracula of the book, it's kind of boring, especially since us as modern readers, we know exactly what everything means, but everybody in the book is running around like, what are these weird flowers? And Van Helsing is like, it's garlic. And everybody's like, why is it garlic? And he's like, for reasons. And they're like, what could this monster that's held away by garlic be? And Van Helsing is like, I'm not going to tell anyone. But we as modern readers, we know what the garlic is for. We know what the weird dog is. We know what the giant bat is. We know why there are two pinprick holes on Lucy's neck. So honestly, reading Dracula the book in the year of our Lord 2024 is an academic exercise. But cool, new Bram Stoker.
Yeah, I'm gonna pass on ever reading Dracula ever. The only other bookish news, which Kelsey did pop in to tell me one bookish news item. The sequel to Assistant to the Villain. No. What's the sequel to Assistant to the Villain? Apprentice to the Villain.
Apprentice to the Villain.
The third book has been announced, and it is Accomplice to the Villain. It's coming out in August of 2025. If you are into that book series, you can go and get excited.
What word? I wasn't sure what word she was going to use. I was like, okay, Assistant, Apprentice. What's next?
Accomplice.
Yeah,
accomplice
no, to the that, villain. I mean, technically she's been an accomplice the whole time, but she needed another A word.
She did.
So I get that.
So we're going to get into our discussion of Butcher and Blackbird. At the time of this recording, the Goodreads rating is sitting at a 4.06 star rating with 327,000 reviews.
So that is so many reviews.
Just came out in April of 23, so what, a year and a half?
Yeah.
327,000 people reading and reviewing. That's insane. It's the first book in the Ruinous Love trilogy. The third book is expected to be published sometime in 2025.
I think it's Scythe and Sparrow. Sparrow and Scythe. It's Butcher and Blackbird, Leather and Lark, and then Sparrow and Scythe.
Yes. Cover will be orange, according to Goodreads. So obviously this genre, this is a dark romantic comedy. And we're going to get into the book description.
All right. So, Butcher of Blackbird, the description is, when a chance encounter sparks an unlikely bond between rival murderers Sloane and Rowan, the two find something elusive, the friendship of a like-minded pitch-black soul. From small-town West Virginia to upscale California, from downtown Boston to rural Texas, the two hunters collide in an annual game of blood and suffering, one that pits them against the most dangerous monsters in the country. But as their friendship develops into something more, the restless ghosts left in their wake are only a few steps behind, ready to claim more than just their newfound love. Can Rowan and Sloane dig themselves out of a game of graves, or have they finally met their match? And Nikki, what are the trigger warnings?
Read us those trigger warnings.
I'd love to read you these trigger warnings.
But this is a book, guys, where if you're thinking about reading it, you definitely want to look at the trigger warnings, because there is some questionable content. So we're going to read them right from the book. This is from the author. We have eyeballs and eye sockets, amateur surgery, skin ornaments, chainsaws, axes, knives, scalpels, and a lot of sharp objects, accidental cannibalism, not so accidental cannibalism, questionable use of a mummified corpse, lobotomized manservant, ill-advised use of kitchen implements, I'm sorry about the cookies and cream ice cream, in parentheses, I'm not really, detailed sex scenes, which include, but are not limited to, cockwarming, rough sex, praise kink, anal, adult toys, choking, dom-sub interactions, genital piercings. On the second page of the trigger warnings, we've got references to parental neglect and child abuse, parental loss, not depicted, references to child sexual assault, not in detail, and then it's a book about serial killers, so there's some generally messed up murder and chaos.
Can I read the dedication?
Yes, please.
Okay, so on the page, after that lovely list of trigger warnings, I'm a big advocate for trigger and content warnings. I think, honestly, this is the best use I've ever seen of them in a book, because she really gets to everything. But even after that, her dedication is, for those of you who read the trigger warnings and said, accidental cannibalism, count me in. This one's for you. Thank you. It was for me. Podcast listeners, I'm a Hannibal fan. I think NBC's Hannibal is the height of art. I think it's great. I think accidental and not so accidental cannibalism make for fascinating reading. Thank you, Bryn Weaver, for writing this book. No, what were you going to say, Nikki?
No, so in our trigger warning, I had to Google something. I had to Google cockworming because I didn't know what that was. So in case y'all don't know what that is, so that is the act of just like holding a cock in your mouth, ass, or vagina, but not doing anything sexual with it. Like,
yeah, just while you're holding it in a warm orifice for an indefinite period of time with no active stimulation.
Right, with the point of like your partner like going about doing their business, so it's completely non-sexual. Like they're like checking their emails and you're just sitting there with their cock in your mouth.
Yeah, although in this book it's not mouth, it's he just like fucks into her sometimes and stays there.
Yeah, which I was expecting it to be a little... I was expecting more from the cock warming.
I was also expecting more from the cock warming.
So I was a little disappointed. After I Googled it and knew what it was, I was like, all right, I'm here for this.
See, I was a little disappointed because I've read some really excellent scenes, specifically with the dom sub element, where like the sub will just be on their knees on a comfy pillow beneath the dom's desk with their cock in their mouth while the dom like checks emails and make business decisions. And there's one actually where the desk couldn't be seen from the other side that had a whole business meeting while their cock was just being warmed by their sister.
I want to read it.
I will find the title for you. Amazing. They will kind of blur together at some point.
We'll let you know in the comments. Yeah. If you also want to read about better cock warming. So in my mind, like I literally
like a cock and a little muff.
I was like, okay, you know how you have like those like ice pack thingies in the freezer. I was thinking of like the opposite, like the ones that like you put in the microwave and you like wrap it around. And I was like, maybe this is the act of like making a cock just really cozy, like its own like warm blanket.
I'm imagining like a dedicated cock mitten.
You go to the store and buy. Yeah, I'm kind of embarrassed about that. I don't know what kind of.
No, you went out. You encountered something you didn't know, and you went out,
and I was like, "Google!" I was like, "Google, please tell me all about
this."
There's
no embarrassment in educating yourself.
Never. So yeah, so I mean, I do think, however, that there is money to be made in cute little, like cock muffs. You know that you could put in a microwave. I think penises maybe want to be cozy. So guys, listener, question: let us know if you have a penis. Or know someone with a penis that you could ask. Let us know if you think a fancy like penis muff would be.
Yeah, like the ones filled with rice that you put in the microwave. Like it could be shaped like a vag. It could not.
Well, no, I was thinking like you you know, kind of like crocheted with like autumn leaves and stuff. You know, like it's like if you want your
something classy
penis to be cozy,
it's something that could be mistaken for something that does not go on a penis.
Right. So it's like an outfit, like an accessory, like a warm fall accessory for your penis. I'm sorry to everyone who's listening. You made it past the listener discretion advisory. So
yeah, if you're still
enough for this.
If you're still here after listening to us discuss the content warnings, then you're enjoying this. You're welcome.
Okay. So also there's a playlist. And I love a playlist in a book, especially when the playlist is good. But I did enjoy this playlist, and it has a little Bryce Savage on there who I just discovered recently and absolutely love. So you can, of course, go on Spotify because people have made this into a playlist that you can specifically listen to. So you can go and enjoy it. I enjoyed it. All right. So, Phoebe, tell us about the tropes.
So the tropes for this book are slow burn, morally gray main characters, rivals to lovers, one bed, and forced proximity. But Nikki, you had thoughts on the forced proximity?
I mean, I'm getting these right from, you know, the Goodreads description.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they were really forced to be in proximity to each other.
I agree. They very much did plan to be in proximity to each other. Yes. They, in fact, went out of their way to be in proximity to each other. I disagree with that tag. Sometimes Goodreads is wrong. A lot of times Goodreads is wrong, actually. So I would not. I agree in that forced proximity was a bad tag for this.
So we're going to cross out force and we're going to put planned proximity.
If you like planned, intentional proximity, if you like consenting adults deciding to get closer to each other, that's what this book is.
Also, I guess quite literally, there's touch her and die.
Yeah.
Quite literally. So we'll add that on there. Let's get into our spice rating. I gave this book 4 jalapenos. I'm rounding up to 4 jalapenos because our serial killers are a little kinky.
Yeah.
You know?
No, for sure. I mean, I would agree with 4 stars rounded up just because I read a lot of content, guys. What qualifies for 5 stars in my world is quite extreme.
Yeah, I don't think this qualifies for 5 stars.
No, but I...
Or 5 pinos.
Yeah, no, but I agree. Yeah, I agree with the 4 stars. I mean, there was a lot of... I mean, the sex was really detailed. They use specific language toward the end of the book when they finally do start fucking. It's, like, pretty immediate and continuous, like, hardcore orgasm denial. He's pretty obsessed with his semen. He spits in her mouth at one point after having gone down on her. Yeah, there's spitting.
There's some like semen play going on a lot of that.
With the dom sub stuff, there's a little bit of brat play as far as like her playfully disobeying his orders, him threatening her with a good time. The good time, aka consequences, ensues. There weren't any, I will say, with all the kinky stuff, this is not the book you go to if you want kink negotiation. Like, Sarah Kate's Salacious Players Club is kinky, where all the characters are, like, having conversations about hard limits and safe words and stuff. The closest Butcher and Blackbird get to that is they do have a conversation where Butcher asks for her safe word before he does something, and she gives one, so clearly she knows what a safe word is. That's about as close as they get to negotiation, but everything they do, they both enthusiastically consent to.
Right.
They do a lot.
They're doing it so like wildly out of the norm for like BDSM relationship.
Yeah.
No, you know what I mean? Like,
They don't actually, for 2 serial killers, none of the sexual stuff they do has anything to do with like pain play, sadism, masochism. There's no blood. Like, as far as kink stuff goes.
Yeah. That's what I was expecting, to be honest.
It's mostly power play. They both enjoy orgasm denial, edging, stuff like that. Like, for them, I would call their sexual escapades a quite sweet. A very sweet, kinky, fluid-filled 4 stars.
Fluid-filled 4 stars. You heard it here first. So, as far as our sweet peppers go, I also rounded up again to 4 sweet peppers. There are a couple things that I thought were so... just deliciously sweet between the 2 characters, but I don't want to ruin them for you guys if you're planning to read the book. So we are going to talk about some of them in the spoiler portion at the end when we're all done. The one thing I will mention, though, there is a scene where
the male main character gets drugged, and while he's drugged, he does kind of like let all his feelings go. This is before they've like confessed that they have feelings for each other. He's like, "You're so pretty, like I want to touch you," and I thought that was really cute.
He definitely does not use sweet language. But the sentiment is very sweet. No, I agree. They were really openly affectionate with each other. It is very much a slow burn, but once they get together, they're very affectionate. They're open with their affection. They have pet names for each other. There's a constant reinforcement of how much they care about each other. So I agree. 4 sweet peppers. Very sweet serial killers.
Very sweet serial killers. And although it's a slow burn for them because the story in the beginning takes place over multiple years, but it's not so much a slow burn for us. I don't feel like it takes the reader very long to get to the romance aspect between them.
Because
there's that time jump. They're constantly, you know, they're time jumping from 1 year ahead to 1 year ahead.
I would have said I consider it only partly a slow burn, not because of the time skip, although that's fair, but because you get both of their perspectives, and I mean, this isn't really a spoiler because it's literally within the first 5 pages. Within their dual perspectives, she is very much the more flighty character. He is very much a murder puppy. He's very enthusiastic about things. Like, he's down bad for her pretty much immediately, but she is a much more cautious character, so you can tell she cares about him. But like, from her perspective, the burn is so slow because she has these like really high walls up, and she has to work on lowering them. But from his perspective, pretty much the minute you go into his perspective, he is down bad of her, down flat. He wants her so bad, and he will do anything to keep from spooking her in order to keep her in his life. So it's like 50% of a slow burn where one of them is like, yes, let's get married. And the other one is like, you must scale my mountains of trauma first. And also, I have to let you. And then multiple years pass. I think it's 3 years, almost 4.
I think so. I think, yeah, because at one point, until they get to the point where they're actually having sex with each other, he says it's been 4 years.
Yes.
That he, you know, because he takes on like a self-imposed vow of celibacy. Basically, once he meets her, he's like, no, that's it. Like, he's not with anyone else. I thought their banter was really cute. I thought their flirting was really cute. It's typical of like a contemporary romance, which you don't really think goes with serial killers.
No, I agree.
So again, our sweet, sweet serial killers.
So sweet. And I did think their banter, 60% of it, I thought was really, really good. The other 40%, I think that Bryn Weaver has maybe never heard a person speak before. I found it awkward, contrived, and frankly, awful. But we can get to examples in the spoiler part. But 60% of the banter was truly excellent. I could feel the chemistry on page, which is really hard to do, especially as a romance writer. But man, that 40% that didn't work, it sure didn't work.
See, it's so strange for me because I generally don't, and I'm calling this contemporary romance because it's not a fantasy romance.
Yeah, no, well, no, it is. So it takes place in the real world in our times. The gimmick is just that they happen to kill people.
Yeah. And normally I just hate contemporary romance because I just feel like it's so fucking unrealistic. And I guess the reason I didn't hate it is because you have to suspend that disbelief of it being in like our world because they're serial killers. And I think that's the only way that I could get into their romance.
I also have a hard time with contemporary romance. I'm usually a fantasy reader. I also have trouble with the suspension of disbelief / I live in our world. I don't want to spend my imaginary time here either.
Exactly. And being that I live in our world, I know what romance is like in our world.
But suspending disbelief enough to believe that two vigilante serial killers find each other and find love made it much easier to get along with the banter. And I do think, you know, I do think, again, that 60-70% is really well written. Like, their chemistry is not forced. It sizzles off the page.
Yeah.
I was really impressed.
I like that quote when you said two serial killers. If one gay lion tamer can find love with another gay lion tamer, then there's hope for you. So, guys, if you're single out there and you're pining,
if two vigilante serial killers can find each other and also have compatible justice kinks, there's hope for you.
Okay.
getting into my favorite part, always, the smell report. We've got dual smell report this time. So Rowan, male MC, smells like, and I quote, warm sage, lemon, and a hint of spice. Something I did not know about sage is that it's actually unsafe when taken in high doses or consumed for a long period of time. And I wonder if maybe Grinweaver knew this.
Is it, like, unsafe? Like, it'll poison you or it'll give you a rash? Or
I think it will, like, poison you.
Oh?
Yeah. Which I thought...
Sage?
Sage.
Isn't sage one of the things you burn when you're, like, cleansing houses and stuff?
Yeah, but you also cook with it. And, like, a lot of, like, British food, like, that, like, sage is really prevalent. It's, like, a whole...
Yeah, but not... I mean, you don't put that much sage in what you're cooking.
Well, I mean, I guess you can't eat sage every day.
Okay.
So says the internet. And we trust everything the internet says, guys. But I thought... like metaphor if she knew that and was kind of going for that.
I love how much credit you're giving this author. It's sweet.
And then Sloane, our female MC, smells like ginger and vanilla.
At one point the author also name drops a specific perfume. I know I marked the page, I can't find it right now, but it's, you know, it's something fancy French that ultimately boils down to also ginger.
Okay, great.
Yeah, it's eau de gingembre or something like that. But it's, so we're given a specific perfume name, but it's ginger.
Okay. Yeah, I kind of glossed over the specific perfume name because I knew I wasn't going to be able to pronounce it. Because I do not do a French accent. But both of these could be candles. It's not like, you know, our male MC of When the Moon Hatched that smelled like smelted stone and cream. You know, these are actual things that we can smell. We can make candles out of these people.
Listeners, you can't see my face right now.
But I can.
But Nikki can. And if looks could kill, every time I think about the smell report from When the Moon Hatched, I get a little bit angrier. So go listen to that episode. You'll understand.
So PD, since you're new, what would your fantasy boyfriend smell like? What would he smell like?
That's so hard. I have two answers to this. The first one is the food route. Just, you know, for boyfriends who smell like food, I think my boyfriend would smell like sea salted caramel. I would love that. And like whipped cream, like a hint of something sort of vanilla and fluffy. So okay. I want to devour him, which is appropriate for this book. My more podcast-y answer, as far as like the smell has to be one real thing and maybe like one made up thing and one thing that doesn't have a smell. I think my fantasy boyfriend would smell like smoke from a fire and cloudberries and autumn light, like that early morning light in autumn when it's filtering through all the different multicolored leaves. And so it's
like dating the same fantasy boyfriend, because that's what I said.
No, my husband. Okay, wait a minute.
No, that's fine. Maybe they're friends, true. Maybe they just hang out in the same autumn forest.
Yeah.
Okay.
Instead of wood smoke, it'll be pine and cloudberries and light through dying leaves. That's what he smells like.
Beautiful.
And I've got my salted caramel boyfriend on the side. Yes, I've got my salted caramel piece on the side.
So let's talk a little bit about the characterization. We're going to talk about our main characters. The one thing that was extremely clear to me off the bat was that they were both giving Dexter vibes.
Yes, absolutely.
So for anyone that hasn't seen the show Dexter, Dexter is a serial killer that kills people who are morally corrupt. So just kind of the same vibes.
Yeah. I also, in Sloane, I saw a little bit of Hannibal Lecter, just in that, I will say for characterization, one thing I really enjoyed about what the author did was that each of them are serial killers, but they're very different killers, and it plays a lot into their personal style. Butcher is probably a little more Dexter. He's got that innate urge for violence, and then he channeled it into violence towards those he views as undeserving of life. Whereas Sloane is also a justice killer, but she's a little more methodical about it, and she's very Hannibal in that, for anybody who read the Hannibal books or saw the NBC TV show or any of the movies, Hannibal's calling card as the Chesapeake Ripper was turning his victims' bodies into really elaborate pieces of art.
And that's really similar to what Sloane does. So she doesn't just kill, but she transforms the body in some way. And she's really careful and methodical about it. And I think that matches who they are as people.
She had more of, similar to Dexter, how she had that itch. That, like, after a while, she was, like, struggling. She was like, I feel the need to kill someone. And I feel like that was very similar to Dexter. Because that was what he called his dark passenger, right? He was fine for, like, a short period of time. And then after a while, like, had to go out and kill someone. And she had kind of the same.
Yeah, and I don't think Butcher is described as having quite the same urge. It's more that he encountered a lot of violence in his life and figured out it was useful and, like, kept an eye out for that.
More of like a Batman, like a vigilante, yeah, sort of.
Yeah.
Like,
he doesn't feel, like you said, that, like, bone-deep itch that Sloane has, which actually is one of those things that we know a little bit more about serial killers. As difficult as it is to class serial killers psychologically, that idea of not being able to go a long time without acting on your impulses that Sloane has is really accurate to real world serial killers. And that's part of the reason that serial killers and spree killers get caught so often is because there's only so long they can go without satisfying that urge. And there's also only so long they can go without escalating. And you especially escalate when you meet a like mind. So, like Butcher and Blackbird, meaning, you know, it's like Bonnie and Clyde, meaning when you meet someone with that same proclivity, even in real life, when serial killer pairs come together like that, it does unlock, change, accelerate things.
I have a question. When we talk about our side characters in this book, each Sloane and Rowan both have people in their lives that know their secret, right? She has her best friend, he has his brothers. Phoebe, do you think that you could know that someone in your life was a serial killer and be okay with that? Because in both instances, the people around them are completely supportive. Like, Lark is like, yeah, you go fucking kill. You do it, and you go fuck Rowan too while you're, you know,
yeah,
like, you get yours, baby. And Lark, the brother is like,
Lark is almost too supportive.
Right? And she's not a serial killer. Like, at least with the brothers, at least the one brother, he's like a mobster, a gangster. Yeah. He also,
yeah, like,
is violent in nature.
He disappeared people before.
Yeah, definitely. The doctor brother, I don't think so, obviously. But yeah, Lark is just like an indie music artist. And she's just like, yeah, I'm here for you, babe.
Yeah, like, they talk on speakerphone while Blackbird butchers her victims. And it's like totally normal for them.
Yeah, and so I don't know if I could know that my bestie was a serial killer. Like, I don't know what I would do about that. So that's just, like, what do you think? Like, let's talk about your sister specifically. Okay, first off, I don't know if I could support Rebecca as a serial killer. Hope, for some reason, I could see being a serial killer. And everyone being like, okay, well, that's just hope.
I agree with you, actually. I mean, I guess if we're talking about serial killer as in the, like, Butcher and Blackbird, they are, they are serial killers in that they have killed multiple people, but specifically they're vigilante killers. I mean, I don't think I'd be comfortable with it, but I also don't think I would turn them in. Like, I really do wholeheartedly believe in the sanctity of human life. I'm anti-death penalty in all counts. So I think if I knew that any of my siblings were serial killers, if they were vigilante killers, I don't think I'd be jazzed about it. But I don't think I'd tell anyone. And I do think I would help them avoid the law. Like, I think if they asked me, I would. And I can definitely see Hope killing people just, like, as a matter of course and be like, yeah, he had it coming. And I'd be like, well, if you said so, Hope, absolutely. Rebecca. I guess I would want to talk to Rebecca about what her criteria for killing was. I would just want to be so sure that she was so sure that they deserved it. But, like, also, if she called me and was like, help me get rid of this body, I would. So I really hope none of my siblings kill someone, because I'm now putting in a recording that if they asked me to hide a body, I would actively aid and abet their crimes. I wouldn't feel great about it.
Right.
I would, you know, I would go to church about it. Well, yeah, but, like, what if it's Nan or Parker? Maybe she uses her car.
Be on board with it. Like, I couldn't be like, hey man, you need me to, like, help you plan this murder, but I could just look the other way, I guess.
So you would look the other way, but you wouldn't aid in a bet.
Right. And I wouldn't want to hear about it. I don't think, like, with Lark, she's like, yeah, let's talk about it, and she wants to hear about it. I don't think that I could be that involved and be that supportive.
Yeah, I could
of my serial killer family members.
I could be supportive, but
I would aid and abet. I just wouldn't be happy about it, I think, but I would. Okay, so family, if you're listening to this, you can never kill anyone. And if you do, don't call me. Because one, y'all will help.
And this will be brought up as evidence in the court of law.
Hey, and then the podcast will be famous.
True.
All the true crime girlies will love us. Because we will be the crime that is true.
Other kind of characterization, like, question. And again, this is for someone with siblings or really close family, I guess. Is Rowan seems to have a super normal and healthy relationship with his brothers, just like any regular person would have. And it just, I don't know. For some reason, when you're throwing in this serial killer aspect, it just doesn't seem believable. Like, I know he's got childhood trauma. Why is he normal with his family?
Okay, I'm going to have to refute the entire premise of your question because he's not normal with his family. As someone with siblings, one of my only complaints about this book was the way that he and his brothers talked to each other. Now, everything they did for each other, as far as like being ride or die, like as somebody with siblings, I get that. Obviously, I've never actually had to help my siblings like hide a murder or stitch them up after they killed someone. But I would, even if I'm, you know, and it's not like my siblings and I are, you know, the fucking Brady Bunch. We're not all together all the time. We're very spread out. We're very different. But as far as that sibling impulse to help each other, especially considering that they all went through the same trauma and they're all very close in age, I think it was actually really realistic the way that they all helped and supported each other. If you grew up in a house where, as siblings, you were brought closer together by what happened instead of driven apart, I found that to be very realistic. Honestly, the least realistic thing about it was the way that they talked to each other. I have 7 siblings. We do not talk to each other like this. They call each other dipshit. They call each other asshat. They call each other moron. And that's not, I mean, I don't know. If you have siblings and you talk to your siblings this way, like, I thought that that was totally unrealistic, bordering on stupid. Like, I want to know if Bryn Weaver has siblings or if she has brothers specifically, because my brothers clowned around like that when they were teenagers. But honestly, I found it really irritating and guilted and difficult to suspend my disbelief before with how often each of the brothers were ribbing each other. Like, their youngest brother is a doctor and he's really smart. And in Rowan's own thoughts, he calls his younger brother a fucking nerd. You don't think like that in your own head. You don't say that out loud to your sibling. You might be like, nerd. And sort of like the fucking nerd is implied in the way that you say it. But like, siblings don't throw profane nicknames like that at each other every other sentence.
See, and that's the thing that I thought was like, I don't want to say unrealistic isn't the word. I'm really been around like a group of like bro brothers. But I just thought that, again, that was kind of like something that was like almost too normal happy. Does that make sense? Between them, because they like joke about like the childhood nickname, like when they're at like the younger brother's house.
That is a
and
stupid.
Like
that is a stupid childhood nickname.
It is a stupid childhood nickname. But I'm
not
saying,
it was not cute.
Like, how? Why were the interactions more dark? Why were they
so
friendly?
Okay,
and so loving and so supportive of each other.
So you expected it to be more charged, a little more fraught with emotions, a little bit like our dark past.
Bad past, like I kill people and you're a serial killer, and but yet we're gonna like have drinks and like party at the restaurant, and I don't know, I just
you wanted
I don't think that serial killers behave that way. I don't think that serial killers are like really sweet and loving with their girlfriends.
Okay, so
and having champagne toasts, like
you want
that,
3 brooding Batman.
That is exactly
and they funny. Weren't brooding. Yeah, no, none of these brothers are brooding.
There's no brooding.
Yeah, they're Irish, but there's no brooding. Honestly, I enjoyed the fact that they weren't brooding, but I also have a very low tolerance for brooding men in fiction because, like, you really have to have a good reason to brood. If you have, like, one sad in your background as a brooding male character, I will not take you seriously. I'm like, that is not enough to deserve that. Pull on your big boy pants and get going.
Are you thinking about Jon Snow as you're saying that?
A little bit. Look, so you're a bastard, John. Oh, poor John. You had that is one sad in your background. You have one sad, but you're the broodingest man in Westeros. I'm sorry. Agree to disagree.
Anyhow,
honestly, I found their sort of upbeat interactions to be Okay, it was a little unrealistic. Because, like, my siblings and I have been through trauma. Not trauma like that. But, like, you know, you don't need alcohol or bad memories to, like, have fraught interactions with your siblings. But I also, I mean, I think they were like that because they all just decided to be like that. One of them, you know, one of them works in a restaurant, but he also actively murders people in the name of vigilante justice. And one of the other one is still an active enforcer for the mob. So I think things weren't as fraught.
He makes
like
cute little leather things.
Yeah. Purses. He has hobbies.
Hobbies and interests are good.
It's important to let men craft. I don't know. I didn't mind the lack of brooding, but I feel like that is a valid thing to me.
It works in the story. It works with the story because this is like upbeat and this is supposed to be like comedic. But I'm saying if we were transferring these characters to the real world, it is fucking unrealistic.
Well, I mean, I don't know any
serial killers. I don't know any. So,
well, and serial killer is also just a designation for like how many people you've killed in what amount of time. You don't have to be a psychopath or a sociopath or any kind of fucked in the head to be a serial killer. You just have to go out and decide to do it. One could argue that deciding to do it automatically makes you one of those things, but you know.
It's like a chicken or the egg kind of a situation.
Yeah. Like, do you really decide to go out and kill a bunch of people in a short period of time if you were okay the whole time, or are we just proving a point about brooding? No, I didn't mind it, but I see where you're going for. I mean, I think it's just a choice of how to react in the face of trauma. It's like, well, if this is going to be our day-to-day, we're not going to be all broody about it. I guess Fionn's a little brooding, because his response was to move to the middle of the country and have as little contact with them as possible. But yeah, when they do meet up, they're like, hey, nerd, like, affectionate, and he's like, asswipe. And I was like, that's not how siblings talk to each other. I don't know. I liked that it was bubbly, but I respect the desire for more brooding. More Peaky Blinders, if you will. That's three Irish brothers who brood.
See, I've never seen Peaky Blinders.
Cillian Murphy is so hot.
I have trauma in my past that makes me unable to watch that TV show.
And that's
namely a specific haircut.
And that
I just can't do it. Can't do it.
It's all right. You're safe here.
The haircut is not following me here. So I don't want to reveal too much of the plot, but I will say, obviously the plot is murder. I'm fucking squeamish. Not gonna lie, I'm squeamish. But the murders were a little too gruesome for my taste in parts, especially with the cannibalism, accidental cannibalism, intentional cannibalism. Like, I literally had to put the book down because my stomach was turning.
Yeah.
At some parts, especially with.
Well, I mean, you've got a thing about like vomit and blood, right?
I don't want to see anyone's blood, and I don't want to hear or see anyone vomit. And that was part of it, because she's actively killing someone at this point, and he's coming out of his drug state, and he's like vomiting into this bowl. So we have him just like vomiting in the bowl, and she's killing someone, and then someone else is just intentionally being a cannibal, and I'm just like, what?
So I'm a Hannibal enjoyer. I think that NBC's Hannibal is a work of art. If you haven't seen it, it features a cannibal. And a lot of the show is filmed. It's filmed like a kitchen prep documentary, except you're watching the things that are being prepared in the kitchen are organs. So I'm pretty desensitized to the cannibalism stuff, both like encountered it in media and also existentially. So I was fine with that, and vomit's fine. Honestly, it was the chainsaw that got me. Thing about chainsaws, I don't know. Somehow I find it more terrifying to imagine somebody coming after me with a chainsaw, just because of like what it would do to your body. Like, something about the dismembering of a body specifically with a chainsaw is what got me. So that actually was like the cannibalism. I was like, this is fine. But the minute they were like, there were chainsaw noises in the distance, I was like, nope, I have
You're
to
like,
put it
no.
down. Yeah, I was like, I have to take a couple deep breaths because this is the chainsaw killer. And all that was on the page was that one sentence of like, they heard a chainsaw in the distance and then screaming. And it was like, nope, Phoebe needs a minute. So chainsaws, not for me. But I thought everything else was written. I mean, it was written solidly.
I'll have to go back to the cannibalism situation, because I don't think I'm revealing anything by saying, hey, there's a cannibal situation, because it's in the blurb.
Yeah.
Or in the trigger warnings. But, and again, we've said there's a situation where he's drugged and she has to pull the fucking human body parts out of his mouth so he doesn't fucking choke and die. And I thought that was actually really funny later on when she's like, I took the human carpaccio out of your mouth so you didn't die. So, like, give me a little credit.
Yeah, I did. I really loved that we're literally, there are three serial killers in the room, and two of them are so deeply existentially disgusted by the idea of eating a person that one of them pauses in her butchery to scrape it out of his mouth because she's like, I didn't want you to go through that. And he's like, thank you so much. And
then he throws up.
Yeah, he vomits the contents of his stomach. But I enjoyed the maybe unintentional hilarity of having three serial killers in a room and having two of them basically look at the third serial killer and go, what the fuck is wrong with you, you eat people? While she's plucking out someone's eyes.
You know that cannibalism in real life will make you actually literally go insane?
Yes, it is. And see, this, kiddos, is why anybody who tries to tell you that cannibalism is the natural state of man,
it sure isn't,
is a fucking moron. Prolonged exposure to eating a human body will make you ill. It will build up, I don't know, chemicals or compounds or something that our bodies are not meant to process, and it will make you go insane. And that is one of the most unrealistic things about the character of Hannibal Lecter. You cannot have a steady diet if you
argue that Hannibal is a bit insane.
Well, no, he is, but as far as like
actual, like
he would be cognitively atrophying. He would not be swanning around Boston like a Renaissance man, acting completely normal.
Right.
Although I guess if he did it sporadically enough, he could sort of spaced out your human consumption instead of eating it every day. You could maybe avoid poisoning, but no, human meat will poison you.
Yeah, it sure will. So don't eat your friends, guys.
Yeah,
and your friends are not delicious.
Friends are friends, not food.
Friends are friends. I love that.
Yeah, and I thought that even in a book dealing with cannibalism and popping out eyeballs, we didn't get loving descriptions of rent flesh or descriptions of, like, the way eyeballs felt and stuff. So despite the fact that they're doing gross things on page, she didn't luxuriate in the image or the feel of it. So I think for most people, this is, like, a pretty good baby's first serial killer book. Because it's not like she's telling you what organs feel like. She's just like, and she plucked out an eyeball. It's pretty neutral language.
Right. And I would think that if you're used to reading, like, mystery thrillers, that you're probably used to all that language and all those descriptions, and that this is probably nothing for you.
Yeah.
But considering as I don't read mystery thrillers, I don't.
Yeah. So I guess to somebody who reads a lot of horror, this is like...
Oh, true. I forget that's a genre. Because I wouldn't touch that shit with a 10-foot pole.
Meanwhile... my AO3 account is full of loving depictions of human carpaccio.
Not for me. Not for me. So, I guess that brings us to our rating. Phoebe, what's your rating for this book? Tell us.
I give it a solid 3 to 4 stars, and I should clarify that for me, my 3-star rating means that I was absolutely neutral about a book. It means that whether or not I would recommend it to someone is based entirely on what I know of their reading taste. I'm veering towards 3.5 to 4 because I enjoyed it. To me, 4 stars is a book I actively enjoyed and would recommend to people, and 5 stars is a book that I will be buried with, like a mummy, with all my riches surrounding me. So for me, this
in Brodart. The book will be in Brodart.
Yes, the book will be Brodarted. It will be with my mummified corpse, the rest of my ride or dies. So I would do 3.5 to 4 in that I enjoyed it, and I would recommend it to anybody who actively liked this genre. And if somebody asked me what I thought about this book, I would say it was well written enough and it was entertaining enough to give it a chance. Whereas for me, like, 2 stars, you're dead to me. I will warn people away from you.
Oh, yeah.
So 3.5 to 4.
So I didn't even know how to rate this, and I'm going to end up kind of giving the same answer. I'm rounding it up to 4 stars. Not because for me, I personally loved it, but because A, I thought it was well written. B, I thought it was interesting. C, it kept me, you know, it kept me going. I thought the spice was pretty good. I don't know. I mean, I didn't hate it. I didn't hate it. I didn't actively hate it. And I felt more than neutral about it. And I feel like for people that like this genre, I feel like it deserves the 4 stars.
Yeah.
So,
no, I agree.
So I feel like that, like, if I'm trying to be, like, an objective reviewer and not put, like, my personal bias into it, I think it deserves the 4-star review that it has. Is it for my shelf? Do I want a special edition? Do I want a hardcover? Do I want to read book 2? No.
Yeah, I feel the same, honestly. I enjoyed this book, but I probably won't be keeping it on my shelf. I actually did get the bookish box edition, and I'm going to let that go to somebody who really loved it. I appreciate that serial killer romance is a thing. I appreciate the whimsy of her writing. I like the fact that there were pretty much no grammatical errors. I never wanted to throw the book. And compared to most of the stuff,
conforming.
Yes, and you
learned something.
You learned something. So I would recommend this to anybody who thinks that a serial killer romance with a dose of whimsy sounds up their alley. I think is worth reading, but it probably won't stay on my shelf just because, like, I've read fan fiction from the Hannibal fandom. That shit is high literature. Like, Donna Tartt, cry your heart out. You have nothing on the people in the Hannibal tags on archiveofourown.com. I'm sorry. So this is not for my shelf, if only because I've been ruined for serial killer romance by the top tier of serial killer romances.
Fair. This being my first serial killer romance, I mean, still not for my shelf, but I think it's for the people.
It is for the people.
It's for the people.
I say this is a book for the people. We the people declare that Butcher and Blackbird is a solid 3.5 to 4. Give it a try.
All right. So thank you guys for listening to our spoiler-free review of Butcher and Blackbird. Make sure you check out our social media, like, follow, comment, tell us what you want us to read. Let's engage. If you are a serial killer, feel free to leave us some anonymous comments. We won't rat you out, you know, about whether or not these dating life. Like, we want to know if this is realistic for your serial killer dating life. Please don't stalk us. I don't know.
Yeah. If any of my siblings are listening to this and you took umbrage with anything I said about you, I'm really sorry. We can brood about it the next time we're in the same state together. But also, I stand by what I
said. Don't be mad at me either, Rebecca and Hope. Like, it's all affectionate, please.
No. Be mad at Nikki. She's the one who brought it up.
No, I love you guys. And I hope your dating life is going well, Rebecca. I'm following in on TikTok every day. Every day. But anyway, thanks, guys. We're going to be doing our review of That Time I Got Drunk and Saved a Demon next week. Kelsey will be back. If you want to stick around and be spoiled and talk about the spoiler review, come backstage with us. Are you guys still here?
Yes, no, what?
All right, so let's get into some of the spoilers for this book.
Bro.
Now you can say all the mean things you want about this book.
Okay, I don't actually have that many mean things to say to each other. And I feel like for our audience who doesn't know me, you should know I'm a really pedantic writer. For me, more important than plot, than characterization, than pacing is the actual craft. Like, the word choice that they choose on the page is really important to me as a reader. So I will nitpick at things that a lot of other readers will look at me and be like, why the fuck do you care about that? I care, okay? And Bryn Weaver is a really solid writer, but there are two rules that she doesn't know because she hasn't been writing for that long. And on the one hand, rules were made to be broken, but you have to know what the rules are in order to break them. Like, you don't get to bust right out of the gate into a craft and do whatever you want and call it being anti-establishment. You have to understand the establishment and the foundations of the craft in order to then choose to break them. And there are two things that Bryn Weaver does in this book that drove me batty. First thing is how many times she used the word fuck. In a book, even if you have a character who swears like a sailor, you can use the word fuck once a page maximum. You should not even be using it that much, because the more you use a word, especially a piece of profanity, the less impact it has on your audience. And she uses the word fuck 2 to 3 times a page, and both of her characters use it the same way. But that means that in the moments where a well-timed fuck would make me laugh, I was just really irritated to see the word fuck.
Because you were just desensitized to the fuck.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't think that that's how people talk. I mean, I'm flipping through trying to find some examples of it. I literally went through my book with a pink pen.
I see that you actually wrote physically in your book, and it hurts me.
And I get that, but like, she needed some help on a word choice level. So I don't know, like, on one page, on two pages, we have Butcher just saying the word fucker, and then on the next page we have him thinking about how sexy Sloane is, and he's like, oh, she's so sexy, I want to fucking die. And then down below in his thoughts we have, imagine what she could do with that fucking mouth. And that's already, I've said the word fuck 3 times out loud now, and it's tired. And, oh, at the beginning of his chapter here, we have the Orb Weaver. I'm sitting across the table from the fucking Orb Weaver, and she's fucking beautiful. You choose one of those fucks. You can choose, I'm sitting across the table from the fucking Orb Weaver, and she's beautiful. Or you can do, I'm sitting across the table from the Orb Weaver, and she's fucking beautiful.
Yeah, and either way, the delivery is kind of more, yes. You know?
But when you put the fuck in both places, you just get tired of it. And she does that through the entire book, and it made me so tired. I just don't think people talk like that. And there were definitely times where I found her dialogue and the way that they spoke to each other to be a little clunky and unrealistic. At one point, Sloane says, that certainly sounds dubious for certain. You only get one certain there. So it's just stuff like that that is, I'm literally have a bone to pick with a single word. But when I'm picking that many bones, it gets really tiring. And I feel like this is why every author should have to read their book aloud to themselves before publishing it, because you get a sense for how dialogue works and what sounds real and what sounds like you've never heard of
it. You need to read it like a script with your bestie. Yeah. Back and forth, your dialogue, to make sure that it flows and makes sense.
Yes. And the other thing with the fuck specifically is that for the beginning of the book, both Rowan and Sloane are using the word fuck in the same way. But then randomly on page 55, if I marked it correctly, Rowan all of a sudden, when he's saying fuck to himself because he's Irish, she changes it to an italicized phonetic spelling of feckin' Egypt. Whereas before this, before page 55, when he said the word fuck or fucker, he said it normally, it wasn't italicized, there was no indication of his accent in it. But then suddenly he's saying, on page, in italics, fully spelled out like this, Rowan, you feckin' Egypt.
So when he's, I noticed this because I remember you mentioning it, we were talking about it earlier in the week. When he is like thinking about himself is when he uses the Irish accent. And I noticed that 3 or 4 times throughout. And I thought that was a strange choice. But at least it does seem to be consistent.
Was it cool? Because I feel like in the beginning of the book, there are examples of him saying fuck and fucker. So why, I mean, why are we switching between the American fuck?
Think about when you're talking to someone that has like a New York accent and they get frustrated and all of a sudden that accent comes out.
Okay.
That's kind of how I saw it.
Okay. I'll buy that. I will also say that I was incredibly annoyed by that being the only indication of his accent in his writing. I was annoyed by the italics. I was annoyed by the way she wrote it out. I think she should have chosen to go full phonetic with his accent or had Sloane describe it. But instead, she just did that one feckin' Egypt. And I hated it. But I'm biased. But I will buy that it's when he's thinking about himself.
So you're very wrong, but I still hate it. You know what I fucking hated?
Yeah.
The semen ice cream.
Oh, you're going to hate this even more then. Would you like to know what I thought the ice cream was before she said semen? Would you like to know what I thought it was going to be made out of?
What
do you use to make ice cream?
Salt.
And?
Vanilla.
And?
And milk. Oh, God, you thought it was going to be like breast milk or something.
Before the reveal that the ice cream had semen in it, I was fully prepared for it to read that it was made of breast milk.
See, that does not ick me out. As much as the fucking semen. Because the label on the semen was like harvested. But okay. I'm picturing a tub. Like, you know, like you get the Breyers, like the little half gallon at the grocery store.
Yeah.
$6.49, you go to Publix.
Yeah.
Like, look at my hands. Well, you can't look at my hands. But like, make the hands.
Make the hands. A pint of ice cream.
And they're like, the semen was harvested between 3 days. It's like April 10th and April 13th. How much fucking semen did you have to produce?
Oh, wait, are you saying that the semen substituted one of the normal ingredients for ice cream? Because I thought he just made ice cream and then mixed the semen
in. And just, like, put the semen in there?
Yeah, like fudge.
Okay, like, I...
Okay, I'm so sorry.
No. See, in my brain, I was like, that's the thickness. That's the ice cream substitute. Like, that's the... You know what I mean? Like, that's
what I
thought. But it makes a lot more sense knowing... How much? I don't know. How do you know how much semen generally comes out at a time? But that makes a lot. So I can't. I'm going through my brain. I'm like, who do I know that listens to this? Can I say this out loud? Okay. So it's definitely not the milk substitute. It's definitely a flavor addition.
Yeah. So I figured it was ice cream, semen flavored. Which I do, actually, I agree with you. I also find that more disgusting than if it had been made of breast milk, because specifically because I've read the Hannibal fanfiction, and I DNF'd it because Hannibal was jerking off over all the dishes he gave Will, and I hated it. And I hated it here, too. So congratulations, Bryn Weaver. It was disgusting, and the man who made it did deserve to die. Good for you.
But you know what, though? Like, in continuing with this, why is it cookies and cream flavor? Okay, maybe it's because it's pie cookies and cream.
Oh, I didn't
get that. But I was like, wouldn't it make more sense for it to be, like, salted caramel? Or, like, sea salt? Like,
listeners, you're not seeing the face I'm making right now.
Not my fantasy boyfriend smell! But, I mean, if we're talking about it as a flavor addition...
No, it should have been salt. You're right.
Okay.
No, you're right.
We're gonna fucking move on. And if you know me in real life, do not bring this up.
If you know me in real life, you know that I have had weirder conversations than this, so you can bring this up. I consent to that.
Well, I guess, I don't know. I mean, Rachel could bring it up. Like, I'm thinking of, like, the 12 people that listen to us and know us, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, actually, listeners, you can bring this up.
Yeah, we can discuss this more in detail. But just don't judge me.
Okay. If you're listening to this and you're judging us, you need to take a long, hard look in your mirror. And that's all I'm going to say about that. Let he who is without sin cast the first stone, motherfucker. If you're judging us, why are you still here?
Because we're hysterical.
That's why.
So, one of the things I wanted to talk about the Sweet Peppers. So, she draws a doodle of a bird, of a raven, right? And she leaves it on a napkin on the table. Yeah. And then, you know, some undisclosed time in the future, he takes his shirt off. And he has her fucking drawing tattooed on his body. And in that moment, I was like, I don't care how many people you killed. Take me now. Wife me up.
Yeah, oh my God. Rowan was so down bad for Sloane that I had such a good time in his perspective. Like, language things aside. Honestly, I was here for him on the first page when they've met and he's rescued her from the serial killer and they're having lunch at the diner. And his inner monologue is literally just, no bra. It's the Orb Weaver and she's wearing no bra. I'm just imagining all of his little serial killer rain spells running around like, red alert, there is no bra under that shirt. Like, he is so puppy love, golden retriever, down bad for her. And when we got the tattoo reveal, it's like, okay, you know that he's been pining after her for years and years and years, but a tattoo?
I know.
He saw that random doodle. He was like, fuck, I missed the chance to see her outside of our annual kill-a-thon. What am I going to do about this? I'm going to put her random doodle on my skin because she's everything to me. Like, yes, my friend born, wife me the fuck up.
I am a sucker for a couple tattoo situation. I don't know. It's just, it's pinnacle romance for me.
See, normally I'm icked by couple tattoos, but I think because we're already in, like, the fantasy land of cute serial killers.
That's why it's like,
I was like, oh my God, that is not a red flag. That is so fucking sweet. Like, that shows how committed he is to this thing. And I also, honestly, also talking about the Sweet Peppers, one thing I really liked that she does is by showing you both of their perspectives, this is one of the better written miscommunication tropes I've ever seen, because you have Sloane is so insecure, but she knows that about herself, but that also doesn't necessarily help her get over it. But also Rowan knows that about her. Like, there were multiple times in the book where he got close to saying something about wanting her, but then he sort of dialed himself back because he was like, no, I know Sloane, she's skittish. She will blow away like a feather in the breeze and I'll never see her again if I come on too strong. And the way that they both mediated that in their coming together, I thought was so sweet. The fact that he was always like, I cannot spook her away, even if this is all I get from her. Like, I have to preserve her place in my life. Oh, I'm so down bad. So good.
And then her little version, you know, she gets the nipple piercings because she remembers from their first meeting that he's staring at her tits.
Yep. He got her doodle tattooed on him, and she said, I got nipple piercings for you. And then when he notices the nipple piercings, he spends the whole drive internally screaming, nipple piercings, nipple piercings, nipple piercings. Like, I just, the earnestness of how attracted they were to each other and how honest they were about their desire, I really enjoyed. Like, I almost wish that we got, not necessarily more of them fucking, but, like, I wish that we got to languish with them when in the scenes when they were together. Instead, it was just sort of like a bit of a list of all the things they were doing to
more like we were watching them.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, experiencing
yeah, I wanted to be
their
in,
feelings.
I wanted to be in that moment and like I wanted to feel the love. And I could. I think I wanted to linger a little bit in the post-coital bliss. But it was very much like a yeah, so I wanted to linger with them in their intimacy a little bit. And it really came off a little bit more as like, here's a list of all the things we did to each other because we loved each other so much, but I wanted to like be in that with them.
We loved each other so much, I grabbed my semen and shoved it up inside your pussy.
Yeah, that was it.
So I think one of the last things, did you see the whole David? Did you see that coming? Okay, so I did not see it coming, but that's just because I don't ever see anything coming. In books. I just like, I'm like a passenger on a ship at sea and I don't think about what I think is going to happen. I just like roll with what's happening and just like take it in. So I did not see that coming. I did specifically remember though her saying that she had put cameras in the kitchen. So she had the suspicion earlier on when she put cameras in the kitchen, but I thought those cameras were so she could watch him from afar because she missed him. And I thought that's why, but
be both though because she's so methodical when it comes to her killing, like it wouldn't surprise me if she did that specifically because she was suspicious, but I also feel like it fits with her MO as a character. Like she is very methodical, she is very controlling as far as having power over her own space and the things that impact her life. It also wouldn't surprise me if it was just like a little thing she did so that she could watch him. Like I think there is a totally romantic explanation for that. I didn't necessarily see David coming, but also when Rowan, like before you find out who the figure behind the gun is, I was sitting there and before I found out who it was, I was like, okay, there are two options to this. One option is the weird other serial killer that Rowan initially wanted them to kill together.
The doctor.
Yeah, the doctor.
Yeah, that's who I thought it was going
to
be.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, it has to be the doctor or literally who else is there? I was like, oh, fucking David. So I thought it was one of those two and then I flipped the page and it was David. But I actually, on the one hand, good twist. On the other hand, I have a bit of a bone to pick with that twist because nothing satisfies me. I am never happy. Here's my bone to pick with that twist. When you first encounter David, he's acting all zombified and Sloane immediately is like, oh, that's a lobotomized person. And I'm like, my first thought would have been that's just a really severely mentally ill person, but lobotomy works too. But then we're never told that there are scars on David. Like, Sloane is such a detail-oriented killer, and David, at the end, you learn, is, like, completely fine. So I find it implausible that somebody as methodical and detail-oriented as Sloane, who has killed as many people as she has without ever getting caught, did not...
We'll just look at him and go, lobotomy.
Yeah, and
when that's not a thing that we do anymore.
And then didn't look close enough to be like, that man has absolutely no scars. Like, she stood right next to him in the kitchen. And then also my other little tiff with this book is I get that we're in serial killer fantasy land, but they took something from every single encounter with their other killers. And that's not how you avoid getting caught. They killed the guy in West Virginia and they took his cat. You know,
they got Winston.
He was the cat.
Oh.
And then they killed the cannibal and they took fucking David. And then they killed, who was the one in between? I know there was the chainsaw guy. There was a victim who lived. Who saw both of their faces?
Yeah, that's
and just ran away. And there was no moment. Like I expected at one point, I expected Sloane to be like, "Here's my shirt. If you ever tell anyone you saw me, I'll fucking gut you." But like nothing. That woman just runs away scot clean. And then there's a third kill in there where I know they take something. So they take something from each of those places, and there's not even a token concession to like, "Here's how we hide this." And I found it a little irritating because Sloane is such a methodical character that I get we're in serial killer wonderland, but you've told me she's careful and then I don't see any evidence on page of her being careful. But I guess,
absolutely,
yeah, they just don't care.
I mean,
that's
just come back and bite them in the ass because, I mean,
yeah.
As far as taking something, though, I think that's a very common thing with
murderers. I just wish there was...
And that's how they get fucking caught.
Yeah, that's how they get caught. So that was my only thing, but that's relatively minor because, again, we're in serial killer wonderland. Although I did want to wind back to the other thing, the other rule that I have, and I know I've talked so long,
The other rule that I have that you have to know about before breaking, although I argue that no one can break this rule, if you know someone who has broken this rule and done it well, please tell me. You cannot have a character in a piece of work that is entirely in the written medium whose character trait is making references to pop culture. You cannot. And that is Lark's entire character. And honestly, as much as I enjoyed this book, that's why I'm not going to read Leather and Lark, because a whole cornerstone of her character is making references to other pieces of media, and it's not funny to read about. It's funny to listen about, and it's funny to watch. In a written medium, you cannot have a character who makes references to things, because making the reference is entirely in how you make the reference, and you can't convey tone in the written word like that. The only reference that I will give Lark is when they're watching Keanu Reeves in his Constantine movie, because that movie is fantastic, and we should have gotten 12 more of them.
I personally hate pop culture references at all. I hate when a song title is mentioned. I hate when a movie, anything, because it's going to date your fucking book. Because 10 years from now, someone's going to pick up Butcher and Blackbird and be like, Constantine, what is that?
That's already a dated reference.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's just, I hate it. I fucking hate it.
I do not, yeah.
You can make statements, but you just leave Keanu Reeves out of it, man. And I get it that maybe you love Keanu Reeves, and like maybe you and your bestie, and it's your inside joke, and you want to put it in your book, and that's not really fine. I was going to say it's fine, but it's not fine. Don't fucking do it.
It's not fine.
Just don't do it.
Pop culture references in literature do not work unless you have a highly specific reason to have the pop culture reference there, and that is part of what you're getting at.
Or you're referencing something historical. Like, you can reference Jane Austen. That's fine.
Yeah. She's a member of literary canon.
That's fine. But you can't reference characters. Sorry.
Seeing Keanu Reeves was my one exception. You are the only exception. Yes, you are, Keanu, but no. Everything else that Lark said or did, and I think in the beginning of the book when we're told a little bit about her, we are literally told, oh, Lark always has, like, a quippy reference from some book or movie or TV show, and I'm like, great, so Lark needs to die. I'm like, look, and we have proof that this doesn't work, because that book is called Ready Player One, and it was steaming hot garbage.
Okay.
But that's a separate episode.
Because I really fucking enjoyed Ready Player One, and the year that I read Ready Player One, which was the year that it was before it was adapted into a movie, because our book club at the time was doing, you know, before adaptations, I fucking loved Ready Player One, but I'm also an 80s baby. So all those references are references to things that I grew up with and things that I loved.
Rebecca also loved Ready. Rebecca, my older sister, who's 30, also
not an 80s baby.
No, she's not. And she also loved it, which means that I have to love both of you, despite the fact that you are objectively, you can like the book, but you cannot look at me and say it is a good book. It is a steaming hot pile of garbage, and I love them both anyway.
Entertaining book. It was an enjoyable, entertaining book. The movie was Conquer.
Agree to disagree. But yeah, so if you know anybody who has successfully written a character who the backbone of their character is making references to other pieces of media, and they did it in a way that was actually funny, please tell me, because thus far, in the written word, I cannot think of a single example. So, future writers, nix every single reference, and you get one fuck a page, maximum. And also, if you have characters who are siblings who call each other sister or brother or sis or bro, unironically, no, you don't. But that's it. Other than that, hell yeah, semen ice cream. Although we would have preferred breast milk ice cream.
Or to change the flavor, the ice cream.
Yeah, okay, so pop off. Semen or breast milk, guys?
Let us know. Thank you guys so much. Thank you so much for sticking with us through this whole fucking unhinged episode.
Plot twist? No, they all left. They all left half an hour ago. They no one here.
We left after cozy cock jewelry or cock sweaters. That's when we lost them.
Cock muffler.
Cock
muff.
Muff? What do you call ear muffs?
Cock muff. Muff.
Yeah. So bless you all. Thank you for listening in.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Phoebe, for filling up for Kelsey. This was so much fun. I hope you come back for another episode. Again, like, comment, review. Tell us everything. Tell us everything about what we talk about all the time. And join us next week for That Time I Got Drunk and Saved a Demon. Bye, book besties.
Bye.